Hi, this is Lou Ann Bird, and you're listening to Bird on a Wire, where we are having conversations about hope, civility, and action. Thank you for listening on the Civic Media Network.
With that brief introduction of me, I am excited to introduce Alan Borsick. You can tell us a bit. I just know you from education and your reporting for a number of years.
That's true. I was a longtime reporter and editor at the Milwaukee Journal and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and developed a big interest in education and covered that for quite a number of years. I left the newspaper in 2009 in one of the many rounds of staff reductions. They were paying people to go away, and I said, oh, I think I'll take the money. And started a short time later at Marquette Law School. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't teach anyone. No one knows what I do. Well, that's not quite true. I work on the public policy projects that we have at the law school, including the political poll that we do. The bulk of my time is spent working on the law school magazine, and I still write pieces for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on K-12 education. So that's continued to be kind of my specialty issue.
So if I could go back a little bit, were you always interested in journalism as a young boy, or when did you figure out that was going to be your career path and personal mission, sort of?
It just sort of happened. It's, I suppose, a long story. I started working. I grew up in Madison, and I had a friend who was working as a newsroom assistant. Frankly, at that time, they were called copy boys because it was tough work. Only boys could do it. It involved lifting up paper, things like that. These days, we would call them messengers. So he was working there, and they needed another person, and he called me and said, you want a job? I started on my 16th birthday, and I've worked in newsrooms from then until, well, I don't actually work in a newsroom anymore, but I still have a news presence. So that's, oh, goodness gracious, 57 years.
Okay. So that's in your life's journey.
I liked being in newsrooms, and I just ended up sticking with it.
How did you end up in Milwaukee?
I got a job at the Milwaukee Journal, right smack out of college. I married. We graduated from UW-Madison. We got married. We moved to Milwaukee, and I started at the Milwaukee Journal all in the space of a week. It was the week of Watergate, in fact. But my wife is a native Milwaukeean, and in fact grew up not too far from where we live now on the northwest side of Milwaukee. And thought I'd go. I worked for a newspaper for a year and then go back to grad school or law school. And so far I haven't made it back, except that now I work at a law school, which my mother was pleased by that. She always wanted me to go to law school, so I ended up working at one. But I'm, as I said, not a lawyer myself.
Okay. So I do want to ask one more journalism question. We'll get back into education. But what was your, I guess, like you mentioned, Watergate, over the years, what story most, I guess, was most interesting to you, or, yeah, most interesting or important? Or were there a couple? What was that like?
Boy, I don't.
Being in journalism all those years.
A single story, I don't know. I just liked being out there where things were happening and being able to witness them, talk to people. You know, being a reporter gives you an excuse to ask people questions that otherwise you'd probably get arrested for. So I've been able to see lots of, let's see, important events, even on a national basis, occasionally. And I never was that fond of covering politics, but I did a lot. I did some things that, you know, really did stick with me. I once did a story on open heart surgery, including standing next to the surgeon while he was doing open heart surgery. You know, that kind of thing is fairly dramatic. I spent nearly a year back in the 1980s working on almost entirely on a major plane crash that occurred at Mitchell Field in 1985. A Midwest Express flight crashed, and I got very into aviation investigation kind of stuff, the National Transportation Safety Board and so on. And that was very memorable. I could name a bunch of other things like that. 99% of the time, reporting is pretty routine, pretty unexciting, even boring. But there's that 1% that's, you know, kind of cooler.
So you, at some point, and, you know, my getting to know you was really through your education reporting. So I moved here about 10 years ago. I raised my kids in Oshkosh and then took a little jaunt down the, and I ended up, full disclosure here now, I ended up running for the school board in Oshkosh because the schools weren't wheelchair accessible after my husband was paralyzed in 1990. And so it took me 5 years to figure out where the power was to change that. And it was finally, well, first I got a committee, the ADA committee, which is still running to this day for kids with disabilities and parents to work on issues. Anyway, I did that, and then I had to run. I decided to run and get on the school board. So I did that for a number of years, ended up going back to school board, and did a couple of cool jobs. But my last one was as director of board development for the Association of School Boards, Alabama Association of School Boards. So I ended up taking a job down there, moving down there for a couple of years, and learning about education from a whole different political and socioeconomic and, you know, standpoint. And then I moved back here to be in Milwaukee by my kids. So that my background really does have a lot to do with education. So when I came back here, I ended up on a school board here as well for about 4 years. And it was just a strong advocate for seeing that as a way to, you know, really solve a lot of our problems, is making sure kids get a good education, making sure they graduate with the skills they need. It just seems like a no-brainer to me. Why we wouldn't want to make sure that that happens, and for every kid, you know, that we come across in our schools, that's in our schools. So anyway, so tell me about what you've seen happen over the years in education, as you've been at this a long time.
Well, to some degree, I've covered some education things going back to the 1970s, but I began focusing on it much more in the mid-1990s. I had been working as the editor of what was then the Sunday magazine of the Milwaukee Journal for a number of years, and then I went back to reporting, which is what I really prefer to do, and got involved in a big project that the Milwaukee Journal did in, I believe, 1996, looking at Milwaukee public schools, whether the whole performance of the whole system, different parts of it. There were four of us who each took fairly big pieces of that question. So I did two pieces. One was on the Milwaukee School Board and whether it was a functional body, which was kind of a debatable question, shall we say. And the other was about the most interesting school in Milwaukee at that time, which was Highmount School over near 50th and North Avenue, which was run by kind of a maverick principal named Spence Corte, and they created a real community around the school. And I just had to attract some attention, but I ended up spending a lot of time hanging out at Highmount School. And so this was two different aspects of the whole question of the governance and bureaucracy, and then what it took to aim to change. And I thought in general, education was a huge need in Milwaukee, improvement in outcomes for kids nationwide as well, statewide in Wisconsin, but especially in the city of Milwaukee. And so it was important. It was interesting. I was hoping I could help do some quality education journalism in town. So I just stuck with it. And basically that became my thing from then on. Well, what have I seen, though? The biggest thing I would say is I've seen too little change. In some ways, some really big things have changed. We can talk about the rise of school vouchers and changes in the landscape of education in Milwaukee, which was a leader in the rise of school choice. Other things have, but the biggest things I would say, which is how are kids doing in school, just hasn't changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
The gap between the kids who are dealt a lot of good cards when they're born and the kids who are not dealt such good cards when they're born, as far as likelihood of educational success, it has been so constant and unchanging, and in fact, in some ways, has gotten a little worse over the years. Certainly the racial gaps remain shocking and deeply troubling for the future of not only the city of Milwaukee, but the entire Milwaukee area and the entire state of Wisconsin. I mean, I'm convinced there's a major link between the health of the largest city in the state and the health of the state as a whole, especially economically. In 2004 was the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision on school desegregation, Brown versus Board. So the paper did a whole series of stories marking that. And one of them, I was supposed to look at that racial gap question. And I got out, this is kind of in the early days still of using data on computers and so on. There is an effort called the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, as it's popularly known. NAEP was not as sophisticated then. It wasn't being used as often and such, but it went back to the 1970s. And I got out NAEP data and found they had disaggregated state by state, not more local than that, but state by state, test scores on reading and math for fourth and eighth graders, going back a number of years. And I looked at the Wisconsin numbers, and the gap between white kids and black kids was really large. So then I started looking down the chart just by hand. This is, as I said, no computers mm-hmm. at that time, and realized that the gap between the two in Wisconsin was the largest in the country. And furthermore, that the actual scores on the NAEP tests, which are given to a sample of kids in every state, they aren't given to every kid, but nonetheless, the actual scores for black kids in Wisconsin were the lowest in the country. Lower than Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, District of Columbia, you name it.
Wow.
And I was quite shocked by that. I mean, I knew it wasn't good, but I didn't realize how bad it was in Wisconsin in terms of the success of black kids in school, which ultimately means the success of black adults in the general world. So, and I went back and looked at some earlier years of NAEP, and this had been quite consistent. So I wrote a story as part of this project. It was played as the top story in the paper the day it came out that Wisconsin had the largest gaps in the country, according to this data, between white kids and black kids when it came to school success. And I take some, maybe credit isn't quite the right word, but I think that was the first time that particular fact or set of facts got major attention, and now it's everybody knows that. But the worst thing is it hasn't changed.
That's what I was going to ask you.
So that was 2004. That's 2004. Data came out in the fall of 2002. Is the most recent. 2022 is the most recent, and it's pretty much the same story.
So I was on the school board in Oshkosh back in the early 90s, and that is when CAPS came on the budget. And I remember, you know, getting the sense that Milwaukee was important, Yeah, the three-legged stool. Remember that?
The three-legged stool. Oh, yes.
And then taking away, you go ahead and describe it. They took away the ability of local boards to raise their budgets. So that was the cap part. And then they put the qualified economic offer in place so that school boards could control teacher salaries, right?
This is the first time I've heard that phrase or QEO in about 15 years.
I know. It was all. And what was the third one? The state was going to pick up the majority of the funding.
Two-thirds funding.
Right.
Yes.
And so for 2 years, property taxes went down, and everybody thought this was the panacea. This was going to save public education and taxpayers. And then Howard Fuller was the superintendent also around that time. So here I am, this new school board member, trying to figure out the landscape of education and what we can do. And I'm at the convention here in Milwaukee every year watching. And so Howard Fuller's on the bandwagon with the CHOICE program starting, and that this might be a way to educate, do a better job of educating minorities and low-income students. And let's give the voucher, the money to a private school. Maybe they could do a better job for that population. That's how I observed it anyway. And then there's a school board election and some pushback about that. And boom, before you know it, Howard Fuller's gone because there's a 5-4 board the other way that didn't want that kind of change going on. So I'm watching this from afar and trying to understand what governance is and where is the power to really actually change the landscape, change things for kids. And it seemed to me, and I still believe this, the power really lies in the community because it's who we elect that can make a difference. And so back then we were just looking at, you know, different models providing education, CHOICE, charter, public. And are they, you know, how does that work? Now, you know, it seems like we're kind of back at the same place, but go back to only for different reasons. You know, you got to watch who's getting elected because they're going to ban books and take away teaching of race. And there's others, fears going on. So back then you were looking at governance. I want to kind of go back to that. And Spence Court and his innovative stuff going on there that was really working for kids, right? You would say?
That's a good question. It was the High Mountain School at that time was kind of ahead of the curve as far as being a charter-style school, fairly independent and real community-oriented and so on. And it was a sweet, healthy environment, a very good school culture. Their academic success was not always so fabulous. It was still, you know, you're still teaching the kids of the city, and many of them came from, you know, early childhood situations that didn't set them up to go into kindergarten very well, and the whole list of things. So Highmount was successful, but not fabulously so when it came to actual academic success for kids.
Have you seen that somewhere where it was actually fabulously successful for kids in Milwaukee somewhere?
Fabulous? No. Are there schools that that consistently, I mean, year after year, get better results and are not creaming kids and not taking just the best of the kids or have admission standards? A small number. They have usually some fairly simple list of traits in common, but they're hard to replicate. I mean, if it was easy to replicate, we'd have a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them are somewhat specialty schools. They have a particular emphasis, but that actually may not be the biggest difference. They tend to have really strong principals. I'm talking about the person, not the philosophy, although they have that too. Strong principals who are successful in building strong teaching staffs where everyone kind of is on the same page. They're all heading the same direction. They work together well. The school culture, which is to say just kind of the atmosphere you feel when you walk in even, is very positive. Kids are on track. They're engaged. They like being there. They're happy places, not every minute, every day, but nonetheless, they're pretty happy places. They are serious about setting high standards and aiming for them. They're consistent in their policies on how kids are supposed to act. I don't mean just punitively, but also positively. Mm-hmm. So they're you know, you say, hey, that's so simple. You know, let's get a good principal and get good teachers and have a healthy atmosphere, and we'll have more success. I think that's largely the formula, but it's hard to come up with that. Nonetheless, there are some schools in town that have done this year after year. Are they operating at the fabulous level? No. In the city of Milwaukee, we can get into this. This has been a big subject for me for many years, and especially lately, it's back on the front burner, which is reading and reading scores. Mm-hmm. You know, in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee Public Schools, and to a large degree, all the other schools in town, the private schools, voucher students, many of the charter schools do slightly better, but not much. Anyway, the overall reading ability of students in the city of Milwaukee is very deeply concerning. For many years, it's been pretty consistent that 20% or less of students in the city rate as proficient or advanced in Wisconsin's scores on reading at all grade levels, third grade through high school. And you say, well, that bar of proficient is really pretty high, so let's lower it to the basic level and say basic isn't so bad, which I think there's validity to that point. Even at that, it's about 50% of the kids are below basic, especially in Milwaukee Public Schools, and in the private schools, it's a little better than that. But it's still, there's no school that's getting, you know, 70 or 80% of its students at the proficient level, and there's only a handful that are getting 70 or 80% even at the basic level. As I said, the private schools overall aren't doing much better. You can argue in some statistics they are, but I'm not thrilled by how they're doing either. So there's a across the board crisis for reading in the city of Milwaukee. You could also argue there's an across the board crisis in reading across the state of Wisconsin. The numbers, if you get into the suburbs and elsewhere in the state, are better, but they're still not that great. About a third of all kids in the state, when you put it all together, are reading below basic at the grade school levels, third grade through eighth grade. It's one of the reasons reading has become such a big issue nationally, is because this is going on all over this. The 30-some states have passed laws to push harder on reading and use what's now called the science of reading, which is, among other things, quite phonics-oriented. Wisconsin appears to be about to become the next on that list. It depends on what Governor Evers does with a bill that passed the legislature now, and I suspect it'll become clear what his action is in the next couple weeks as we're recording this. Mm-hmm. It looks like he's going to sign it, but I wouldn't assume that at this point.
Bird on a Wire podcast will be right back.
Hi, this is Lou Ann Bird, and you're listening to Bird on a Wire, where we are having conversations about hope, civility, and action. Thank you for listening on the Civic Media Network.
So there's just these long-term crises in student success, which nobody's really solved.
You know, when I was running, I had a portion of Milwaukee in my district, and I am passionate about our kids in education. And as you were talking, I have to admit, it just pulls at my heart. Because when I was on the school board in Oshkosh, they told us, you know, it's critical that all kids learn to read in third grade because they need, you know, you learn to read and then you need to read to learn. okay, great concept. I thought that was great. Sure. Didn't really change anything for me as a school board member to do anything different to make sure we were raising the bar. We were always trying. We were always trying. Now, I don't think anyone walks into a boardroom with the intent to leave things as they are and not try to reach every kid. I mean, what is it that can motivate us to create the change we know is that you described so eloquently in what it takes? So I was on the board in Oshkosh. Then I take a job with the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, and I get involved in a research project that started in Iowa about what could school boards do to reach kids? What role do they play? What kind of leadership do they need to show? And so Association of School Boards have a great impact on governance because they are our go-to place, right? And it didn't take me long to figure out, well, school boards are going to be no better than what the association is telling us we should be, in a way. There's a very important role that they play. And I found them to be a great resource in governance. However, something's missing on how do we reach more kids without micromanaging? How do you, you know, this hands-off approach is maybe not working. We need to figure out a way. So I got involved in this research where the Iowa Association of School Boards was doing a national research project, and Wisconsin got involved. And actually, I also got to do this work in Alabama. So I've done it in two states where we were involved in this project. And then it pretty much, it boiled down to two things. Beliefs mattered, and the conditions you talked about in the school matter. Those were the two areas that mattered. What they found when they looked at high-achieving districts, and it was just a small number, is that the board believed we could be doing more for kids. In the lower-achieving districts, boards would say things, well, if we just had a different set of kids, you know, they would say things, quotes, that were pretty evident that they didn't have the higher expectations for kids that they did in the high-achieving districts. So all of that really impacted me. I really became quite an advocate for school board governance and what we could do. Not only that, it was how can we engage our communities more in getting there. So my question to you about all of that is, why isn't it changing? What's your opinion on that? Why isn't it changing? Well, I do have to mention one more thing. So it wasn't until I got into this research and I did these training materials that showed school board members what it looked like when a fourth grader couldn't read, which was quite eye-opening, when you actually could see a child struggling with every word in the book, clearly not comprehending what she's reading, just trying to get through the words. What does it look like? And then show the board what, you know, okay, let's think about this little girl and let's look at a manual for fixing your bike or something, or applying for a job. How does this work? How is this person going to read and look at this eighth grade math text, you know, or science text? How is this child going to learn math or science? How is this child going to function in the world if she can't even read this text over here? And that reality elevated my belief in the importance of making sure kids can read by third grade. And every board that I worked with in my research project got there. It was really amazing to see that. But getting to that next level then of what can we do? So what do you say is the reason it's not happening?
Well, and no surprise that there's not one reason and there's no one easy, especially easy solution. I would broaden the conversation to look at early childhood experiences and early childhood programming. That I've seen research that says that the gaps that we worry about so much are really there the day kids walk into kindergarten. That there are kids who are way more prepared to get into reading, who know stuff, and just have had the kind of experiences that make them intellectually curious, that make them value education, that make them think there's some reason why, you know, a general optimism about where they're going. These are all traits that, you know, are developed even at 1, 2, 3, and 4 years old. And there are kids who come in who, I mean, I hear this from kindergarten teachers often, you know, they don't know their colors, they don't know their letters, they don't know numbers, they don't know how to hold a book the right way. more broadly, there are kids who are just really ready to roll when they hit kindergarten, and the kids who are not. And ultimately, schools do a fairly good job of not making the gaps worse. And they do a fairly bad job of making the gaps narrower. The gaps stay there pretty much all the way till high school graduation, all the way until the data you see on who's going to college and getting higher education degrees. You know, the gaps are there. And what's the answer to that? Well, certainly good early childhood programs are one, and there's been some greater priority on that statewide, but the need far outstrips the availability. There have been some centers that have opened in Milwaukee that really do great work with young kids. And including, there are programs that offer parents more encouragement, more knowledge. I mean, no parent wants their kids to not do well. So sometimes, you know, my wife used to work in this many years ago. Sometimes if you have even volunteers or it doesn't have to be someone with a PhD come into a house and say, here's games you can play with your kid. Here's nutrition advice. Here's advice on how to talk to your child. And how to talk to your child is actually a really big deal. That if you have conversations that engage them with, you know, look at the birds, look at the trees, right, look at the store, right, that we're passing, look at all these girls, you know, you're just talking, yeah, about the things that are
world
going on.
Classic.
You know, one of my own pet soapboxes would be, and you're not just putting them in front of television sets with generally lousy programming.
Yeah.
Not all.
No. Sesame Street was my favorite. I have to admit, I loved watching that with my kids.
They
were really
agreed, but I'm an even bigger fan of Mr. Rogers.
Oh yes, those both were great.
I was a huge fan of Mr. Rogers.
Me too.
I think one of the reasons my wife has stayed married to me is that I once took her to meet Mr. Rogers.
Okay.
To Pittsburgh.
That's a plus.
Marquette was honoring, this is before I worked at Marquette, but Marquette was giving Mr. Rogers an honorary degree. And I told the folks up here, I said, I want to go do a profile of him.
Yeah.
So I went to Pittsburgh. And
spent
the day with him. It was very cool. Wow, but in any case, there are really good ways.
Yeah.
Money helps. I'll entirely grant that, but it doesn't all cost money. There are entirely good ways to set kids up better.
Oh,
and we don't, the big we of our communities and culture don't do enough to prioritize setting up kids before they reach kindergarten. Then you get into what can you do? You're right. High standards, a constant assessment of what's working and what's not. And then, you know, the best schools I know of, and I'm thinking of some fairly specifically, are constantly reassessing. If math isn't going well, I say, well, what can we do differently? Do we need a different program? Do we need different training for our teachers? Do we need to find ways to engage the kids more? They're very much into reflecting on how they're doing and what's working.
Yeah, the teachers would tell me on the board, they would say, I remember the teachers were the most important part, and learning that and getting more committed to that as I've gotten older. That, you know, it's easy to talk class size and all this other stuff, but the most important resource we've got is our teacher, is that teacher in the classroom. And supporting teachers and making sure they have what they need can really change our children's worlds. But back to that.
Well, that's why teaching is so highly paid and so highly supported by our communities, is because we so much value. Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
You're in the wrong state. Okay.
Yeah, I mean.
No, there are other countries that do that a lot better.
I agree. I'm being sarcastic that if teachers are really so important, and they are, why don't we do more to make it an appealing job? And it's not just money and benefits. It's just the whole sense of support from a. You know, if you ask teachers, I've seen studies, you know, why they left their jobs. Pay and benefits are high on the list, but they're usually not at the top. Inadequate support from above, I mean, from supervisors and principals.
Uh-huh.
Inadequate support from parents and communities. You know, just frustration that you can't make progress with the kids very easily. And it isn't really the kids' fault.
No, it's, I'm glad you brought that up, because I would ask people this question is, you know, children's, first of all, I'll ask you this, what percentage of our kids in MPS do you think could be achieving at a high level, Alan? What percent do you think really could be?
I don't know the answer to that. I've asked that question sometimes. In the reading.
What do you think is cognitively, what could
frankly, it's not 100%. It's just, you're never going to have 100% success.
But what percent do you think is?
It could be way better than it is. And,
okay.
And it's going to do that would be a long.
Well, that's the question. So if you think it's at, you know, 70%, 90% is possible, let's say. And then what percent is currently happening? What's your current reality?
Well, if you figure that out a little more generously in your definitions. My own guess is it's about 50% lucky. I mean, the graduation rate is in the 60s, but frankly, a lot of kids are graduating high school who are not really doing that great.
I asked a ton of boards that very question, and we'd use sticky notes and educators and teachers that very question when I was doing the research, and it was always a big gap. So then I would ask, well, what is the reason for that? And we could list those, the number of reasons why these kids are not reaching whatever level you think they can. Throw out a couple of your ideas why they're not reaching that. We've already talked about a couple of them.
Oh, I'm good at pointing at problems. I'm not good at pointing at solutions. I totally bug out at that point. It's not easy.
Some people would say teachers don't have enough resources in the classroom. Some people would say class sizes are too big. You know, why aren't kids reaching the potential? The family life isn't so good, right? When you think of all of those reasons.
Family life is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not eager to dump on people for the difficult lives they lead, and there are many people leading really difficult lives. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, that home setting does have a huge impact. The whole relationship between what can be decreed by legislation or even by courts, you know, like school desegregation, and what can actually or what is going to actually happen has been much on my mind lately. No Child Left Behind was the name given to the federal law that was passed in late 2001, signed in 2002 by then President George Bush, with overwhelming bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans were together on this. Mm-hmm. People forget this, that when Bush signed the No Child Left Behind law, Teddy Kennedy was standing at his side, literally. And No Child Left Behind set all these goals and procedures, and it was just a bonanza of acronyms, adequate yearly progress and schools identified for improvement and all sorts of things. Teacher requirements. It didn't change a thing. It was a colossal failure. As far as actually improving the outcomes for kids.
I was consulting at that time.
In 2008, Margaret Spelling, then the Secretary of Education of the United States, the last year or so of the Bush administration, was in Milwaukee. And as part of her visit, she came into the paper for a editorial board meeting. And I was assigned to sit in on this meeting and write up a news story on what she said. I wasn't a member of the editorial board. But I was allowed to take part in the conversation. There were like six or so people at the table. And I said to her, this was 2008. The No Child Left Behind law set 2014 as the date that every child in America was supposed to be reading it.
I remember that.
At grade level. So I said to her, it's 6 years to go, and we're not making any progress. Would it be good to set a more realistic goal and focus on what we could accomplish, you know, more tangibly? And she said, No, she was convinced, and the Bush administration was convinced, that every child could learn on grade level and that this would happen by 2014. And I said, I know this isn't a realistic suggestion, but I'd be glad to go downstairs and get in a car with you right now and go to any of about 50 schools within a few minutes of downtown Milwaukee where it's not going to happen. They're not going to have 100% of their kids on grade level in 6 years. And then we can talk about what are we going to do to help these schools and these kids. Of course, that didn't happen. And the law didn't change until right near the end of the Obama. It was late 2016, early 2016. Well, yeah, that's a whole other thing. But the federal law stayed in effect, even though it was a colossal failure. It didn't meet probably hardly any goal that was set by it. Mm-hmm. And then it was replaced by the current law, which is called the Every Student Succeeds Act. The Every Student Succeeds Act was actually a federal surrender of saying, I don't know, we don't get it. We're just turning everything over to the states, and no one's going to be held accountable for anything because you just never hear about it. And I think that was actually an accurate reflection that nobody really knew quite what to do. What federal policy would really help get kids to read and do math and social studies and science and so on, all in a path to school success? I don't know. I mean, legislation, school boards, legal action can have an impact. I think special ed is one area where you can point to that.
That's the lowest achieving, actually.
Well,
look at breaking down data.
It's
worse.
Probably, but it would probably be worse if there wasn't a federal. A law dealing with IDEA, the Individual Disabilities Education Act. That's what it's called. Right. And that goes back to the 1970s.
Unfortunately, what I've seen is a lowering of expectations rather than investing to raise kids back up to grade level. But that is consistent with how we're treating kids in regular education, too. We're not raising expectations. I got to tell you one story, though. When I was in Alabama, there are these hope stories out there. And I was the director of board development, so I was in charge of all of the events. Well, they have an appointed state superintendent there, and they have an elected school board, state school board in Alabama. So totally different political structures. Anyway, the superintendent calls me. He says, I want to speak at your convention. I want to speak to them. So of course you carve out time. We'd like him there anyway, whoever that person is every time. But so he gets up there and he says, I have some news to share. And couple years before, they took on an initiative to get kids reading at higher levels. And they invested in teachers, reading specialists in every school, and money at every school for reading. And he was there to announce that in just 2 years, Alabama went from being at the bottom to 12th from the bottom in 2 years. And it was a statewide, every school got that investment. And it blew me away. I'm like, see, we can do this if we collectively invest with a goal and a belief that more is possible, right? We can elevate the status of kids. It's possible. Is it about the kids or is it about the grown-ups in their lives? Alan, that's what I would tell people at the doors. Education can be better because it's not about the kids, is it? It's about the grown-ups. It's about the grown-ups not doing the right thing for the kids. So if that's the case, the hope is grown-ups can change. It's not about expecting kids to change. Grown-ups can change, right? And all the things that we've talked about in this podcast, which I'm just sort of feeding back what you've told me, that you've seen over the years, public policy doesn't seem to be doing it, right? Different initiatives from the state level down, even federal level, don't seem to really be closing that gap that we want to see, right? Family life can matter. Children not being prepared when they enter schools can matter. All of these things can matter. So then I say, if that's all about the grown-ups, we just have to, that's fixable. That's still fixable. And getting involved in your local school board, which is happening right now based on other challenges to boards, is giving me some hope right now. that we can reach, that we can do better with our kids in our public schools. Like you said, it's happening everywhere. I heard it like this. When you drive around Milwaukee, it was like, look at those kids on the playground. 1 in 4 is not going to make it, or 2 in 4 of those little children are not going to make it. And why are we not doing more for those kids? It's kids. So if we'd stop talking about systems and types of policies and talk about kids, I found when I knocked on 4,000 doors, Alan, that people really want to take care of our kids. So if we can continue to focus and get people to talk about, what do our kids need? What do we want for these children? We don't want them to fail. Who in this, I used to say to school board members, who on this board is going to line up 10 kids and say, okay, you 4 are not going to learn as well. We're just not going to invest in you. Who wants to do that, right? And sometimes I think just pointing out the reality of what we're doing in real terms like that can make a difference. And I know that you have done your part at making us aware. And so my job in this podcast, I hope, can try to elevate beliefs and elevate some actions toward really making the change, you know, elevating belief that it's even possible. And if it's not the kid's cognitive ability, it's about their environment, it's about the resources, then we can make a difference, right?
I keep
trying.
I'd say 2 things. One is a little aphorism that I exchanged with some of my friends when we're talking about this, that it's so easy to get discouraged, and it's so important not to get discouraged at the same time.
Exactly.
The other is I'm always very skeptical of what impact news coverage of anything has on anything, but including education. Nonetheless, I've written hundreds, literally hundreds of stories about education. I've written since 2009 when I left the paper. I know I wrote over 600 columns in the years since then about K-12 education. I can sum them all up in one sentence, maybe it's 2 sentences, depending on how you punctuate it, which is, hey, folks, we can do better than this.
We can do better. Well, thank you, Alan, so much for taking the time to be with me. I knew 45 minutes would go fast. In fact, we didn't even get to the budget and the fact that Governor Evers just put in a 402 years per pupil increase. I'm sorry we don't have time to explore that, but
I sometimes get the feeling I'll still be covering education in 402 years from now. So.
I hope so. Well, you're my go-to person, and if those of you in the audience have not read Alan's work, please do so. It has been an inspiration for me over the years, and he can lay it out in terms that make me understand. But it's up to us then to take the actions once we become aware, and I firmly believe that's possible. So, thank you.
Thank you for your continuing involvement and advocacy, and thank you for allowing me to be part of this conversation.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to Bird on a Wire on Civic Media. For more episodes, visit us at civicmedia.us. I'm Lou Ann Bird. Thanks for listening.